This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday the 27th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. On this week's episode, we have a mixed bag of treats. Coming up, we get special access to a hallowed nugget of Danish design in the UN building in New York.
There's so much talking, we need action. And I think for me, New York is action. For me, New York is so vibrant. There's so many things happening. So you can see the old world here and you can see the next world.
We talk design and radio with Roman Mars, something of an expert from San Francisco.
I wanted people to focus on the joints and seams and the old stuff and the legacy of built things and why we do the things we do, and do it in a way that was also creating something really radiophonic.
And we attend the Sleep 2012 fair in London, where the hotel sector heads to dress its latest properties.
The fun about a hotel over and above as sort of a call centre when you're designing is people live, sleep, eat, drink, have sex, have fun, die there. The whole world happens in a hotel. It's the most complicated living environment that you can have.
More on that shortly. Elsewhere, we talk the future of bathroom design with Growers design director Paul Flowers. Over in Berlin, we get to grips with open source design and ask what it means for the future of the industry. And last, but by no means least, we pore over the new archives of one of Britain's greatest architects, Sir Dennis Lasdon. That's all to come on this week's episode of Section D. We begin our journey this week in New York. The Trusteeship Council Chamber in the United Nations Conference Building is a long-standing icon of mid-century modern Danish design. And with its restoration and refurbishment well underway, Danish design is reminding New York that it's still very much at the forefront of the field. The Consulate General of Denmark is engaged in an effort set to highlight the heritage and the rising stars of Danish design. You can read more on this wonderful ongoing collaboration in the latest issue of Monocle, issue 59, on newsstands now. This month, eight young designers were invited to participate in Danish Design Review New York, a day-long event spearheaded by Parsons, the new School for Design, and the Danish Design Centre in Copenhagen. Pauline Eiferman from our New York Bureau went along to see what she could find.
Finn Yule was only 38 when he was commissioned to design the interiors of the Trusteeship Council Chamber in the United Nations Conference Building. A century after his birth, Denmark still bets on its rising stars to export their vision and inspire contemporary design in New York. Nilo Yule Sorensen is the CEO of the Danish Design Center, a museum in Copenhagen that holds the annual Danish Design Awards and that helped organize today's event. He says New York is a crucial stop for designers who want to get out of their comfort zone.
I think New York has so much attitude. It's also a city where that's where things start. A lot of things start in New York. Or maybe they don't start here, but they get traction in New York, and then we get them in Europe. But I also think it's about New York is a no-bullshit city. So, you know, if you can't make it in 2 minutes and get people interested, you know, go back home, come again. You know, there's nothing wrong with you or whatever, but, you know, go home, prepare. And I think that's what young designers need, because there's so much talking, we need action. And I think for me, New York is action. For me, New York is so vibrant. There's so many things happening. So you can see the old world here and you can see the next world. So, and I can see the things in between. So I love to drift around in New York and find out, you know, what are the creatives up to? What are the bankers up to? And that shows me, you know, this is the whole world is mixed here, and designers need to come here to find out. It's not just about China. It's not about being home in Scandinavia where everything is, you know, nice and cute and we call it hygge. You need to come to New York, you know, and say, can you get any traction here?
Paola Antonelli, senior curator at the Department of Architecture and Design at New York's Museum of Modern Art, agrees. According to her, Danish design already has universal appeal. All it needs is a little risk-taking.
what's there not to like about Danish design? You know, and that is both the advantage and the problem. I wish that Danish design were sometimes less likable, like more controversial. And I wish I could say, oh, I really don't like that. And it never happens. So I think that American audiences love Danish design because when you generalize, most Americans have not yet learned how to be critical about design. Danish design is almost like the O plus blood group. You know, it's a universal donor. There's nothing you can say about it. I hope that it'll become a little more abrasive.
This is specifically what Niels Juel Sorensen is trying to push for. When he became CEO of the Danish Design Center last year, he vowed to renew the institution and created a new award for young talent. Many of today's participants were nominated. He says bringing them to New York can open up commercial opportunities for them.
It's about business, and I think design is business, and design is big business. And that's what the young people can learn here, that if you want to survive, you need to do something that can sell, that can be a business. And that's what our young designers can learn from the Americans, that you are a lot more hungry, a lot more entrepreneurial, and you have a lot wider net of investors who are ready to take the chance. In Denmark, we don't like to take chances.
But the young designers present at today's event do. Many search for inspiration outside of their creative fields to create products that could have a real impact on people's lives. Like Thea Ube, an industrial designer who graduated last year. Her thesis project, Nesty, won the Danish Design Young Talent Award.
I've spent a month in a children's hospital visiting different units to see where I could address a design-specific problem and go into that trying to solve something through design in a world that is completely different than what I'm used to. It's a comforting product for premature children that are facing a long time of treatment in incubators. Children today are born very premature, and they will spend up to 3 months or more in an incubator. So it's important for them that the environment inside of the incubator is supporting what they need in terms of development, physical and mental development. And I've made this product that you can use inside of the incubator. It's a mattress depressed in the middle with two flexible wings where you can support the child lying in there. You can add pressure to the child's body parts and kind of imitate what the life in the mother's womb would have been like so that it feels more comfort and closeness, and that adds a whole new dimension to a more holistic dimension to the care procedures. Nurses are already doing a lot for the children, but they're doing it with towels and different fabrics rolled and wrapped around the baby. And with this product, it will ease their daily life, that they can actually do what they know is good for the baby.
What aspect of Danish design do you feel that you represent with this project?
I'm very method and process based, and I think a lot of Danish designers have this approach to design, but it's moving in a direction where it's growing and it's becoming more important how you get to the product, and that whole, it's a long way. I never thought of an actual product like Nesty. I had to go out and visit professions and see their daily life and be part of their life to actually get an understanding of what their needs were, so that I could design in collaboration with them a product that would suit their needs. And I think that's quite a different way of approaching design than what we've seen. It's not totally new, but that way of approaching design is growing, and I think to me it's the only thing that makes sense almost, because I would be just walking around in the dark trying to figure out what people needed, but this way I can actually base my ideas and concept on validated ground because I have the backup and the feedback from professions. So I think that's quite special. Yeah.
Anna Danielson also visited hospitals to create medicine trays designed to simplify the nurses' jobs. Other projects included street lamps with built-in wireless antennas and foldable lamps inspired by Iranian art made out of recyclable plastic. According to Thea Ube, there's a growing number of Danish designers interested in reaching new fields with their work. She says it's a movement that can re-energize the practice.
The field is broader than the legacy, and design is broader than that. So I just think that we're seeing this trend that people go in different directions. It's easier when everybody knows Danish design, but now we can add a new dimension to that, and I'm quite happy about that, because we can see the versatility and the diversity in what design and Danish design can be.
Also present at the event was Søren Rose, an interior designer who traveled between Copenhagen and New York so frequently that he decided to move here. He is currently working on an interior design project for a private apartment on Park Avenue, and says that New York has pushed the limits of his imagination.
Certainly you can see we're Scandinavian, and we have this tradition of craftsmanship and eye for detail, but we're certainly trying to find a new aesthetic that has a more sort of like international, cosmopolitan, contemporary feel to it. And I think that that's what New York is helping us explore. But we're still Danish, and it's still our roots, and it's still the qualities that we, you know, that we come from.
Roots that are very much present in all the projects shown today, from the Le Klimt foldable lamp to the grape table legs. And for those who see this legacy as a baggage, New York could provide just the right combination of admiration and toughness for contemporary Danish designers to reinvent themselves. For Monocle, in New York, I'm Pauline Eiferman.
Thank you very much for that, Pauline. Sticking in the States, our New York bureau chief, Aisha Spears, headed to the Third Coast International Audio Festival near Chicago, where she met up with Roman Mars, the San Francisco-based radio producer and host of 99% Invisible, which he modestly calls a tiny radio show about design. Finding out the best ways to cover objects and design on radio is something we strive to do each week on Section D, and Modest Mars is something of an expert. Aisha waded straight in and asked him how he got started.
It kind of started this idea with the American Institute of Architects in San Francisco and KALW, a local public radio station there. And they had this notion that they wanted to do a little architecture minute, like a little fact about San Francisco architecture, to air during morning edition in San Francisco. One of my jobs is I start and consult on radio shows and the sound design radio shows and what radio shows are all about. And Matt Martin asked me, well, what would you do with that architecture minute? Like, what would you like to see? And I thought about it for a long time. And as I had met with people and sort of figured out what I thought, like my idea was I would just kind of create it and then hire someone to do it or locate someone to do it. But when I met more and more with architects and designers, and I saw this niche, and I saw that a lot of it wasn't covered the way I liked it to be covered in terms of story and sound and humor. And I decided I wanted to do it and expand the notion more than architecture and into all realms of the built world and the human-made things, and also make it longer than a minute. Because I wanted to create like a little gem of a thing that somebody could love. And I thought that a fact or just a short thing wouldn't be enough. So I 1 minute I couldn't do it. I could make someone love 4 minutes. And so I pitched that. We took over a little section of Morning Edition. And then when it came out as a podcast, it took on its own life. And that's why the show is now like longer, and because the podcasters demanded it, and I didn't have the constraints of a radio time clock to keep it one way anymore.
And when you say you set out to kind of cover architecture and design in a way that hadn't been covered before, how was it being covered before, and how did you want it to be covered?
Well, I don't know the totality, so I don't want to like disparage all things, but my sense was that I wanted to cover the mundane, honestly. Like I wanted to find the amazing facts in the mundane and not cover, you know, fancy glass, you know, like blown out images with white behind them. I didn't want to do that thing and talk about the new and the new exciting thing and the design firms in that way. I wanted to talk about, you know, manhole covers and sometimes talk about a bigger, newer thing. I mean, I love those things. I love objects. I love nice, shiny things and everything too. But I wanted people to focus on the joints and seams and the old stuff and the legacy of built things and why we do the things we do, and you know what that says about us and do it in a way that was also creating something really radiophonic that was only meant to be audio. And if you transcribed it, the show wouldn't be what it is. It's more about the sound of it and the construction of that sort of thing. I mainly just focus on the story of like how it was made and why and those choices. And that tends to be what I focus on. And so if it's something about the visuals of it, you have to be really careful and precise that you paint the right picture for people. But I often try not to rely on that, and I just sort of let people kind of almost imagine whatever chair they want. But really, it really focuses on the story and the process that brought that chair into being. And I just try to seduce them with a type of enthusiasm for something. And that sort of gets it going, even if they can't quite form a crystal clear picture. Because you never quite know, because the way people listen to radio is kind of, they often are doing something else. And so you can't count on them really, like you saying, well, it's angled like this, and them really following along with you. I just like to focus on the story of the object. It's almost like covering anything in that way. And just because design to me is like, it's much more about a process than a result. And if you have a process, you have a story. And if you have a story, that's made for radio. Radio is made for storytelling.
Some people have likened your model and the example of things like Kickstarter-funded journalism, Kickstarter-funded radio as public radio. Do you see that as a future for where public radio can go, especially as more and more people are able to put up whatever they want online and everyone can discover it? Is that the new way?
I mean, I think it's kind of basically the old way. When people talk to me about crowdfunding, and the reason I did well in crowdfunding and Kickstarter was because I'd done pledge drives for 10 years. I mean, that I did a pledge drive. I just did it online with more people. It's really not that different. It's very fundamentally the same. It's really about using the right tools for the time and recognizing the fact that when people can connect, you know, I do a show that I make to be intimate. I put in personal things. It's about that connection. And so when people want to give money, they want to give money to the show. The station has less of an identity in that transaction, and they can get it directly from me, and it's a podcast. So you want to give people the opportunity to give and support and be a part of it, because they do want to be a part of it. And the thing I learned about the Kickstarter thing was that people are grateful to support things they love. And I didn't know or think to ask, because I thought I was asked, but I didn't realize I was giving people an opportunity that they wanted, which is nice, you know. And I get it from the consumer point of view, because I'm like that with things that I love too. And so the lesson is to try to keep things small, make personal things, because personal things connect more with people. They demand a little bit more of you as a creator, I think, you know, like you on Twitter, you on Facebook, and bring them into the process and to the struggles of it. And there's a, you know, you be professional in every way that matters. You make the best stuff possible, best sound and best interviews and thoughtfulness. And then you be amateur in the way of open and accessibility and vulnerability. That seems to be the recipe that people desire in modern media. And it makes people want to give money to you. And if I was associated with a company that was, you know, that was well off, you know, I can understand why they wouldn't think it was worth it to give money. They're part of the team. And I think that's sort of, so you have to sort of balance and allow creators to connect with people and allow them to fundraise directly. And that is a model that's important. But also the model is like, I mean, like you can make audio things without a big team. You can do it on your own. And it doesn't have to, you don't have to create this multi-million dollar radio program that's an hour weekly on a radio station. A radio show, to me, public radio has to do with the style and content and it being really great. And I think any, like a one person could do that and fund it and be fine.
That was Aisha Spears, our New York bureau chief, with Roman Mars, producer and host of the design radio show 99% Invisible. We'll be off to our trade fair of the week, the Sleep Exhibition in London, which caters for the hotel contract market, after this short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. With consumer markets rumbling along at snail's pace thanks to the continued economic squeeze, many design manufacturers have ploughed their energy into the contract market instead. Hotel furnishing has been a sector on the rise, from small-scale refurbishments to large-scale new developments. With this in mind, exhibitors, architects, hoteliers and developers from all over the world gathered at the Sleep 2012 exhibition in London last week, a design fair aimed at the hotel sector. Our own Hazel Pfeiffer dropped in to see what it was all about.
Sleep 2012 is an exhibition and conference dedicated to all things hotel design related. Last week in London, hoteliers, investors, designers and architects all gathered to network, share ideas and raise a glass to the industry. Between talks, I bumped into one of the industry's most creative minds, Suzanne Oxenaar, Artistic Director of the Lloyd Hotel and Cultural Embassy in Amsterdam. She told me about how her first venture into hotels came about.
I'm always working together with Otto Nam, and both of us, we don't have a hotel background. My real background is I'm curator modern art. And from there, as a curator, I've been working for prisons, hospitals, psychiatric hospitals. And I'm always trying to find new locations for art. And the Lloyd Hotel started because the city of Amsterdam was developing a new part of Amsterdam, and this building was standing alone there waiting for something. And Otto, my companion, saw that and he said, well, didn't you want to start a hotel one day? So then we made the concept for the first 1 to 5 star hotel. But our idea was that we mainly interested in the luggage of our guests, the cultural luggage that they were bringing. So how can we make an environment where we can welcome our guests and bring them in contact with the Dutch culture, bring them in contact with whatever their profession is also, so that we can exchange that luggage that they are bringing. So that's why the Lloyd Hotel and Cultural Embassy, in my personal opinion, is not a design hotel, but it's a hotel with an extreme amount of design. And we have so much design because I think that design and art and culture are the best tools to communicate.
Can you tell me more about your new hotel?
Our newest hotel, Hotel The Exchange, is in the heart of Amsterdam, like really when you couldn't be more in the old center. And it's a hotel where the rooms are dressed as if they are models. Of course, that's a little bit contradiction because a model moves and a room is like standing still. Nevertheless, we worked for almost 1.5 years with students from the Amsterdam Fashion Institute, and we asked this question to them. And the result is an amalgam. I don't know if that's an English word, but it's like a bouquet of completely different rooms, where one young designer used the mattress and taking it apart and reusing it as a new kind of material to dress the room with. Where there's another room, which is like the little fairy tale about the king who doesn't have clothes. So you come in a room, you think there's nothing, but then it's a camera obscura. So when you wake up in the morning, suddenly you see the whole outside of the surroundings reflected on your wall.
Alongside the exhibitor stands and busy conference schedule, the Sleep Hotel Award was a chance for 5 different designers to show what they could do. The brief was to design a hotel room in a mid-sized European coastal city with a mountainous backdrop. The rooms were then constructed on site, where visitors could examine every detail. Conrad Smith, managing director of Reardon Smith Architects, was one of the judges.
The brief was to produce a five-star quality small room. There's lots of big five-star rooms and there's lots of little tiny budget rooms, but we wanted to combine the two because nowadays in city centres, the amount of space that we have to work with is obviously limited, and so we are constantly being asked to produce a five-star quality, but in a 22, 23 square metre area.
Designer Paolo Ribeiro's Cloud Room was a pale, ethereal cocoon of soft fabrics and artfully inventive technology. It focused on allowing the visitor to customize everything from the bathroom and bed to the music and the lighting. If the view left much to be desired, visitors could even choose a wall of glowing soft cell paneling instead.
What we've done is we've actually filmed clouds in Holland moving very, very slowly. And we've worked with Philips on this, Philips Holland, and we've slowed it down even more. And for each of the modes of the room, you've got a different kind of mood, all using clouds moving. So it's a very kind of blissful kind of experience if you just kind of relax in front of them and just let them move at their own speed. What we're trying to do with the virtual cloud is when you arrive, this room is all about you bringing your own device, your own mobile, connect that device to the room, and everything works immediately. The concept for the room was a bit like if you want to make a car faster and more economical, you take the car apart, you separate it into all the different elements, you take a little bit of weight in every single one of them, you put it back on together again, and it's going to be lighter, therefore it's going to be faster, therefore it's going to be more economical. Now, if you try and apply the same thinking to the hotel room, you break up all the different components of the hotel, make every single one of them a little bit better, a little bit more special, a little bit more about giving people options or choice. And when you put it back together, it should feel like a more luxurious experience, therefore worth the 5 stars.
And you don't have to wrestle with 4 different remote controls?
No. All from your little phone will be enough.
That's amazing.
Thank you.
The winner of the Sleep Award went to Una Barak and her team at Scott Brownrigg for their sophisticated take on the log cabin, full of luxurious textiles and dark wood panelling.
The design of the room was something that we wanted to be timeless, elegant, classic, bearing in mind the guest as well as the operator. We focused on the mountainous backdrop. Lindsay Bean Pierce is our head of interior design on the creative side, and she very much sort of spearheaded the project.
In a nutshell, it is a 5-star take on a log cabin. We chose Strasbourg. Well, there is the comical thing, the stag theme, the deer and a doe, female deer. But it was basically a 5-star log cabin, and it was all about timeless quality, which is why we had a very muted palette going from black to white.
The awards and exhibition revealed the amount of thought, investment and planning that goes into developing and sustaining a world-class hotel. For Conrad Smith, designing a hotel microcosm goes far beyond fixtures and fittings.
That's the fun about a hotel over and above as sort of a call centre when you're designing, is people live, sleep, eat, drink, have sex, have fun, die there. The whole world happens in a hotel. It's like a cruise ship, an ocean-going liner. It's the most complicated living environment that you can have. You've got rich people, poor people, all coming together in one building. You know, some like opera, some like hip-hop. They're all staying under one roof, eating in the same restaurants, drinking in the same bars, sleeping in the same rooms next door to each other, meeting in corridors. So it's a microcosm of society in a little space. And thank God it works.
For Monocle in London, I'm Hazel Pfeiffer.
I slipped into the Sleep exhibition myself to visit one of the exhibitors, German bathroom fittings manufacturer Grohe. Based in Düsseldorf, the global market leader is pushing the concept of bathrooms into the future, exploring ways in which wellness and digital technology can enhance our daily scrub. In the corporate area of the fairground, to the background of nightclub beats, I sat down with Grohe's Senior Vice President of Design, Paul Flowers, to hear about the future of our showers.
My approach to design and how we approach design in a team is always, it's very consumer-centric. And if you design for people, you know, there are fundamental needs which unite all of us. You know, safety, convenience, you know, a concern for resource, intuitive products that are very easy to use. And not just products that are easy to use, but products which allow us, empower us to get the most value from the products. I often refer to that as having an emotional connection with an object or a product. And you really can have a connection, an emotional connection. And we've been pushing this for a number of years now, this concept of, you know, from like to love. You know, it's very, very powerful. It's very emotional. But you really can create, I would say, relationships with objects. I mean, you do with jewellery, for example, it has history, it has, you know, a different dimension that goes beyond the physical object. And I think good design does that anyway, intuitively. So that's really very much our approach. How do we unite all of these different countries together? You know, I travel all over the world. I travel a lot. My team, we visit all the major design and trend fairs around the world. It's fabulous, fabulous life, actually. And that allows us to be, let's say, relevant, gives us good insights, but at the same time, and more I just see the synergies and how, I would say, how relevant, you know, simple, good, honest things that deliver and sometimes over deliver and empower people to get the most of that thing, how valuable that is.
Tell us a little bit about how the bathroom, in your opinion, is becoming more of a digital arena.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, the bathroom is evolving from a very rational space, cleaning and grooming, into an emotional space. I think our need in life, let's say as human beings, our need to have time away from the busy, stressful pace of society is increasing. And you kind of see this thing happening in, let's say, in the bathroom, which is probably, it's quite an obvious pattern to see, really. You know, we see collective experiences moving into individual experiences. You had the synth, let's say a cinema collective, now you have a home cinema. You had an office, now a home office. You had, you know, gymnasium collective experience, you know, now a home gym. And we see this concept now coming with spa. You know, you have a collective spa, now you have this individual spa. And that's where the bathroom's going. Now, we're using, you know, doing a number of things to, let's say, to create that oasis, looking at a number of ways how we can use water to do everything that we discussed, from creating a physiological change to using technologies such as digital to manage, let's say, water in a much more sensitive way to ensure that you're not wasting it, not just, let's say, to consume less, but just so that you can have a greater experience with what you do consume. And that's our concept, like we discussed, of ecological enjoyment. Mm-hmm. Sounds paradoxical, but that's our challenge. Anybody can reduce water, just don't use the water, just turn the tap off. But of course, we don't want to do it. Progression is about increasing the experience. It's about having more things. But now I think designers are challenged with delivering more things, but doing that with less. And that's what good designer can do. And digital is exciting because, for me, it's going to take us into areas, it's going to bring power to the bathroom. Now you can start to have different therapies, chromotherapy, you know, aquatherapy of steam like you saw, aromatherapy. So you're going to have a sensorial environment which is stimulating all the senses. You know, and to truly, I would say, to be stimulated as human beings, if you can fire on all those senses, I mean, that's really uplifting. It's a different level. The bathroom has the potential to do that.
Call me a bit of a Luddite, but introducing technology in that scale to the bathroom, what happens if there's a power cut and you can't have a shower? Or, you know, it's as much as it is increasing the experience and maybe has a lot of ecological benefits as well, it also complicates things too at the same time.
What people tend to do is, I mean, I of course, being a designer, a lot of my time I spend, let's say, sitting in the future. You know, so I've worked for lots of companies and I've always had to sit, let's say, in a slightly different place to where the company was at that particular stage. That's how we lead the company onto new things and we lead the market and set trends. And I think people often do exactly that. When they look at an innovation or a product, they tend to take it out of the context where it will be and they pull it into their existing context. You know, so what's to say that as the bathroom evolves into a digital bathroom that we can't use water, the flow of water, to power everything, so it neutralizes, let's say, the energy consumption. What's to say that by using less, you're not just bringing the water, managing water, it's all the infrastructure behind it one doesn't think of. You know, and then where does that water go when it flushes down? We look at all of those things. I mean, sometimes I say, you know, we have to look at every single aspect. You know, we designed a shower that had, most showers had a head at 38 degrees. And so we created the first shower with a 7-degree head, like our signature element. And that allowed me to reduce the packaging by 50%. So I'd sell that product, well, the company sells that product in 130 countries around the world. We could double the amount of products we fit onto pallets, onto trucks, aeroplanes, ships, and we could reduce the carbon footprint by 50%. I mean, so that small insight of just changing the angle of the product and understanding that it's more to, let's say, an approach to ecology than just water consumption, looking at the whole process of how you make, ship, use a product, you know, brings new innovations, new directions that weren't there before. So I think, like I said, projecting forward, I think energy consumption will just come down. Everything's LED-based now. It's already low consumption. If you manage the water, you can offset all that consumption anyway. If you manage, you know, wasting, you know, heated water because it's a predefined temperature that you're ready to step into, and you can easily neutralize that energy consumption with digital easily. And I think more and more so, as market leaders like ourselves push these technologies, we're going to open up completely new industries, you know, like I said, diagnostic areas. You know, imagine if you know you touch a metal object which happens to be the lever of a faucet, that can run a low energy pulse through your body that measures cholesterol, that measures your heartbeat, your, you know, lots of different diagnostic measures, which can just give you information, a feedback that doesn't have to be aggressive, can be very passive, but can really be in the background taking care of you. That's the next thing. That'll be in 3 or 5 years, but right now we're in this emotional transition, you know, showing that an environment like the bathroom, which was so rational, can really serve its purpose to serve us as human beings and let's say, increase our emotional being, let's say.
That was Paul Flowers, Senior Vice President of Design at Grower, at the Sleep Hotel Furnishings Trade Fair in London last week. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll be dipping into Britain's finest brutalist architect, Sir Denis Lasdon's archives, and we'll be asking what exactly open source means when it comes to design. But first, a quick break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus. Creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D. Now, anyone who's strolled along the picturesque South Bank in London won't fail to have noticed the concrete masterpiece, or misfit, depending on your taste, that is the National Theatre. It was the crowning architectural achievement of the late Sir Denis Lasdon. Although never a household name, Lasdon was an architect who more than made his mark on post-war Britain with a number of iconic modernist and brutalist buildings. An archive of Lasdon's work has been recently completed by the RIBA and illuminates his interests, inspiration and thought processes over a long and illustrious career. It's a timely reappraisal for one of Britain's finest 20th century architects. Our reporter, Hazel Pfeiffer, visited the RIBA to learn more.
The name of Sir Denis Lasdon may very well draw a blank outside architectural circles, despite being one of Britain's leading post-war architects. He played a significant role in transforming the landscape of 1960s London, with projects including the National Theatre on the South Bank and the Royal College of Physicians in Regent's Park. A newly completed archive of Lasdon's work at the Royal Institute of British Architects, catalogued by Dr. Barnabas Calder and Suzanne Waters, offers an intriguing insight into the life and times of a brilliant and often controversial architect.
What we have here is what he called his ego file, which, in contrast to a number of architects, one have to say, does have a certain amount of irony about it.
Charles Hind is the head of drawings and archive collections at the Royal Institute of British Architects.
I think no successful architect is without ego. All great architects have egos. But I think that in his case, he was a much quieter, less egotistical. He was convinced he would listen to other people and he wanted to push his vision through. And in this ego file, which starts back in the 1930s, I mean, given that this is a very long career, it's not an enormously large album. Obviously, with a life that long, he edited it, in a sense, as he went along. So he kept what was important to him, rather than keeping every bit of press coverage of his life, which I have to say some architects certainly do. Here, for example, he attended a conference, the Congrès International d'Architecture Moderne, otherwise abbreviated to SIAM, which was a conference that met irregularly of architects, and in this case it was meeting in Aix-en-Provence in 1953. And here is something sent to him by Le Corbusier, which is, I think, is in response to a speech that Lasden had given, in which Le Corbusier signs it, or dedicates this sort of drawing to Lasden, and signs it, "Bravo, Lasden, Le Corbusier." That's the sort of endorsement that any late 20th century, mid-20th century architect would have killed for.
His work wasn't always so popular, however. Lasden came under fire from the press and his fellow architects on construction of the National Theatre, a vast concrete structure in the brutalist style, which Prince Charles is said to have likened to a nuclear power station. The archive houses thousands of Lasden's drawings, alongside models, photographs, correspondence, and video and audio material. In his acceptance speech on receiving an RIBA Royal Gold Medal in 1977, it's clear that although Lasden was a man of his time, his vision went beyond the confines of the era.
And I became really interested in buildings which transcended movements, which remained within the tradition but transcended it, were the products of very specific study of very, very specific problems. I rejected, as indeed a lot of my generation did, the idea of all-embracing nostrums. It was not the moment for it.
Lasden's modernist buildings will be familiar to many, from the horizontal strata of the University of East Anglia to his cluster block public housing in Bethnal Green. Elaine Harwood is an architectural historian with English Heritage, a government advisory body on the historic environment. Familiar with the archive, I was curious if Elaine got a sense of the man behind the architect.
You start to when you're actually looking at the papers, because they've been so beautifully catalogued, and you can go through them in order and look at the debate on, say, the Royal College of Physicians, and you see the sketches, very, very rough pencil sketches of how an idea for a hall for drinks becomes a staircase hall where the physicians process grandly to their meetings, which is something they'd always done, which Lasden observed. And you can see how this sort of three-dimensional thought process starts to take shape. And you see it all happening stage by stage. In that sense, yes, you can see one man's mind working, and that's what the best archives do.
Material from the archive will be placed online by 2014. Funded by the Graham Foundation as a collaboration between Dr. Barnabas Calder at the Liverpool University School of Architecture and the RIBA. Not only a rich source of information on mid to late 20th century British architecture, the archive illuminates Lasden's skill, innovation and sensitivity to the needs of people within places. As a new generation can now discover, there is still so much to learn from Sir Denis Lasden. For Monocle in London, I'm Hazel Pfeiffer.
Thank you very much, Hazel. It makes me very happy indeed that Sir Denis is finally being given the recognition he deserves for his great contribution to London's characterful skyline. For our final jaunt on this week's episode of Section D, we're off to Berlin. Young creatives, short on cash but with buckets of ambition, have been filling up the flats and factory spaces in Berlin since the wall came down. As a result, it's an incubator of new ideas. And one of the more prominent ideas to emerge of late is the notion of open source design. Berlin is host to an organisation called Open Design City, a community of like-minded open source pioneers. Our Berlin correspondent Nikki Ertz went to a workshop afternoon recently and talked to Elisaveta Bersagova, the founder of Open Design City, to find out what it's all about.
The basement of everything that happens in the space is sharing, and sharing in every kind of
meaning that you can imagine. So it's everything from sharing the space, sharing the tools, working together, to sharing the ideas and knowledge, which is the basis of open source. So we have really a whole team of wonderful designers who are ready to share their ideas and their inventions with others.
Designers like Sarah Kennedy, for example.
Me and my friend have a company. It's called Snug Interiors, and we make nice things for your home. Everything's screen printed. It's going to disappear again. Everything's screen printed, and this is one of them. It's a Have a Nice Day bag, which we've been printing recently. And it's kind of the inspiration for today's workshop of using type on bags. But feel free, if you want to draw or you've got your own ideas for designs, then we can look at that too.
The general idea of open design city being build or buy.
Well, the general project which we launched with all the designers in Open Design City is called Build or Buy Online Design Store. And there the concept is that for each of the products you have two options, either just to buy the product or to attend the workshop and learn how to actually make the product with your own hands. So our main slogan is everybody is a maker, and we really want to enable people to use their two hands actually and to realize that it's not something unmakeable. It's really relatively easy to become a creator, to become an actual maker, but just this tiny step, this shift between being just a consumer and co-producing something, in this tiny step they really need a little help out. And that's what designers are there for.
The designers are there for guidance and advice, but you and I still have to bring in the ideas.
So
We're writing a phrase
that we are a big fan of, and it says, what comes after techno? And then on the back side it'll say Tuesday.
Oh.
So it's very suitable for the Berlin scene.
Yes, it is.
May I ask what you're designing?
Yeah, I don't know. I thought I'll make a smiley and some, I don't know, fonts. Yeah, I wasn't really like thinking about what I was going to do.
No, but the ideas come when you're here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's such a creative environment.
And what is the text going to say?
It is what it is. It's got to be kind of short. I mean, it is what it is.
Right? It is what it is. How's it going?
Really good. We're just drawing out the designs at the moment. And then once we do that, we'll get onto the printing, whether it be one colour or two colours. But yeah, we've got a whole heap of different designs going on, which is nice. It's always good to see how many different designs come out of a group of people that have started in the same place. Mm-hmm.
It's inspiring, I guess.
Yeah, really inspiring. I always go home with some new ideas, which is really good. I like to see what people can do with just from the basics of a bit of paper. Yeah.
So a bit of paper is actually all you need.
Yes, exactly. And moreover, if you have a look at the scene of really professional design products, they look beautiful, but they also cost insanely much. And actually the main thing which creates this extra cost for a product is the time which a person devoted to producing it, because they are all handmade. And thereby, when you have a look at the products in the store, you can either buy a lamp for 120 euros, or you can attend a workshop and build it for 40. Mm. This tremendous switch is exactly the effort which you put into it.
We're just preparing the first one to print.
Could I ask you in the meantime why you do this?
Moved from London to Berlin 6 months ago. I'm a freelance designer, and I spend a lot of the time in front of the computer. But one of the things I wanted to get back into when coming to Berlin was getting back into kind of a hands-on approach to design. So I got involved with Build or Buy, and yeah, before I knew it, I was doing screen printing workshops.
So you easily found your way to the Beta House?
Yeah, I was looking for a co-working space in London, and I found a really good site, which I can't remember what it's called, and one of the choices was, yeah, Beta House. So I thought I'd come and check it out, fell a bit in love with it, and yeah, decided to do my, I usually do 3 days a week on the third floor, and then the rest of the week some workshops, and yeah, depends, different stuff every week.
And is it easier to do here in Berlin than it used to be in London?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. London feels a bit more of a closed community. Berlin has this warmth of activities and communal activities in particular. So.
And there's no open design houses in London?
I've heard that they're starting. They're following the trend, but no, not affordable ones, definitely. They need them, though.
That was Nikki Ertz in Berlin. And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Section D. Next week, we'll be heading to Canada for a Canadian-themed extravaganza of a show, taking in the finest the nation has to offer in the fields of design, retail and graphics. We'll even get some top tips on moustache grooming from our new favourite Toronto snippers, Garrison Barbers. So do tune in then. This week's show was produced by Gillian Tobias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and in honour of the Sleep exhibition, I'm leaving you with the haunting vocals of Natasha Khan, otherwise known as Bat for Lashes. This is Sleep Alone. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.